service to NewsHour with James Menendez in London and me, Lise Doucette, in Cairo, the capital of a country where a protest movement has called this day a day of rage. And that's what we're hearing on the streets, not just in Cairo, but in major cities across this country, to the west close to Libya, to the east close to Israel and the Palestinian territory, to the second city of Alexandria, north of Cairo, and to the south in one of the poorest governorates in the Delta. Anger is spilling over on the streets. Let me just describe what's happening just on the street below where I'm now standing, because it will give you a snapshot of the unprecedented scenes we're seeing unfolding here. There have been hundreds of protesters who've been marching down this main street along the Nile, marching toward, with their hands raised towards the riot police. I can see towards the end of the street at the ready with their vehicles and full riot gear. They've been throwing tear gas canisters about one every few minutes. It's not deterring the protesters. They keep throwing the canisters back. And the smell and taste of tear gas is so sharp now that everyone around me is wearing masks. And Amr Hamzawi is with me, was suffering a bit. His eyes were watering, catching in his throat. He's from the Carnegie Institute. You've been watching the protests for the past 4 days since they started on Tuesday as the day of rage. Is today different?
It is different. It is different because it's the third day in a row, the fourth day in a row, in fact, that we see big numbers of Egyptians, I was one of them, taking out to the streets, demanding, not from an ideological or liberal or leftist or Muslim Brotherhood's perspective, but demanding basic social, economic and political rights. And these are different Egyptians. These are not the normal protesters whom I have been seeing out there in the streets of Cairo and Alexandria and elsewhere. These are middle-class families, Egyptian families, demanding justice, demanding freedom and demanding change. And the government has been, depending on the security apparatus, as you have seen yourself, as we are seeing now, and this is not going to take us very far.
But where will this go? When we're watching on Egyptian state television, they say the security forces are in control and they're responding to these protests, which they say are illegal.
You know, they have a frame of mind which really goes back to what has been happening in Egypt in the 1980s and 1990s, where we did see some eruptions and demonstrations. Most of them were related to regional events, but they were one-day developments, one-day activities. Now we are in the fourth day and they are still responding using the same slogans, using the same rhetoric, saying we are under control. They will get it under control from a security perspective today, but tomorrow it will happen again, or next Friday it will happen again, unless the demands, just demands, legitimate demands of Egyptians are being addressed. And these are really, it's a nationwide protest movement which we never had before since the 1970s.
But where are the demands coming from? You call it nationwide. It certainly is taking place in a lot of parts of Egypt, but it's still just thousands, tens of thousands for the biggest ones. This is a country of 87 million people, the largest, most populated Arab nation. Do they really, these people in the streets, speak for the country?
They do, Lise, for two reasons. One, it's a huge development when you compare it to the demonstrations which we have been seeing since 2004, throughout the last 6 years, where we had hundreds of demonstrators, primarily activists of Kifaya, of the Muslim Brotherhood. This is different. These are young Egyptians, male and female Egyptians, university educated, social class, middle class is their social background, and they are protesting. So it's different. Second, it's different because they are not putting forward ideological demands. These are nationwide demands which are accepted by everyone. I mean, who would tell you that we do not need new parliamentary elections after the rigged elections last year? Who would tell you that we are happy with the emergency law, which is imposed on us since 1981? This is accepted.
Amr Hamzawi from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, thank you very much for joining us. And thank you for walking up 19 floors with the waft of tear gas because the elevators are broken as well. Well, these truly are unprecedented times in Egypt, both for what we've been seeing, this defiance unfolding on the streets, the boldness of the protesters, unprecedented too for the force and the reaction of security forces, but it's also uncharted territory for journalists. Hours ago, I saw one of my colleagues from the BBC Arabic service heading out, dressed like what many journalists dress like, with his jeans on and a khaki vest and his white shirt. And then he came back within hours, with his white shirt blood red. He had, he said, been targeted by the security forces, pulled aside and beaten. Here's his story.
It was about 1 o'clock, immediately after Friday prayers. And it was in Ramses Square, the second biggest square in Cairo. And there was a protest of about 15,000 people. It was turning a bit violent. I was keen on standing a bit at a distance, keeping my distance from the protest. That was about 300 meters. but secret police, plain clothes police, obviously were targeting journalists. All I had was my photography camera at the moment. My cameraman was somewhere else. So they kind of surrounded us from the back. Okay, obviously these are plain clothes people. You don't know whether these are police or not. And when they came, they arrested me. I said I'm BBC. They didn't care about BBC or any other organization. They were targeting journalists deliberately. They took my camera away, and when they arrested me, they started beating me up with steel bars, like the ones used here for animals, for slaughtering animals. And it's been really, really brutal. Police are very, very brutal. I'm going to hospital shortly for a couple of stitches to my head, and as you can see from the amount of bleeding, it's been really, really violent. They used electric bars. They electrified me in some way. They used beating me. I mean, they beat me very, very hard.
And what did they say when they let you go?
The thing is, I was kind of lucky. There was a number of foreign journalists there, and they were all being loaded onto trucks in order to be moved somewhere unknown. I was kind of lucky because I saw a very senior officer, and I said to him, I want to speak to you. I am the BBC, and I'm bleeding, and I'm fainting, and I need to go get treatment. They wanted first to take me to a hospital of their own, a government-run hospital. This hospital is notorious for the fact that people go there, get treated, and then police go collect them again. I refused to go there, and I said, if you're taking me there, you'd rather take me in the car and let me faint and die. Otherwise, I would have to go to my own hospital. And here I am.
You've covered many protests here. This one is a lot different.
This one is very, very brutal. The police has never been like this. Obviously, the masses, the numbers of protesters are bigger than any other before. And obviously, as well, the police have so many red lines today. I mean, it's like if you breathe, you've crossed the red line. So police are very, very violent today.
And that's Asa Al-Sawi, who felt for himself, the response of the security forces here. I have to say, every Egyptian journalist I spoke to has really been stunned by what they're seeing unfolding on the streets here. Let's try to take a step back from the emotions of this day and the dramatic events. Joined now from London by Maha Azam, who is an expert on the region and on Egypt, who's with Chatham House, the Royal Institute, the International Institute in London. Maha Azam, what you see unfolding for the fourth day on the streets across Egypt, where do you think this is all going to lead?
I think it's going to lead to the fall of the Mubarak regime. I think he has never been challenged in this way before. It may take time. The military, the army are still backing him. We don't know how long that's going to last. We also don't know whether divisions have already been created in the army with those feeling very uneasy about what's happening. I don't think that the protests are going to go away. As one of your commentators said earlier, you know, we can have perhaps a lull in these. The security is out in strength, but I think the protesters will keep coming back, and they will be coming back in larger numbers. I think what we're seeing is a very strong security presence. But what is also very apparent is that the Interior Ministry and the security forces are not making any pretense that they're coming down hard on the protesters. Despite Western journalists, they are quite desperate. You'd think they try to keep up some appearance of sort of behaving in a slightly more tolerant way towards the protesters. And that's why I think further down the line, we're going to see greater frustration and anger from the protesters themselves.
Well, Maha, I want to go through some of those points that you made in just a moment. Please stay with us because we're going to bring in one of my colleagues, Yolande Nell, who's joined us. She was in Giza, which is part of Greater Cairo, this morning at the mosque where Mohammed al-Baradei, the Nobel laureate, an Egyptian, had joined others for Friday prayers. Yolande, tell us what happened.
Well, really quite surreal scenes as those prayers were underway lines of worshippers in the street kneeling down opposite lines of riot police who were ready with their helmets on, with their shields there and their batons. And just as soon as prayers were finished, people started shouting their slogans, "Go Mubarak, go," illegitimate, referring to this government, and they confronted the police, moved in on them, and quickly water cannons were fired. Then we had canisters of tear gas, as you're hearing from your location now as well, and the police managed to disperse the crowds. They came back, people were running into the side streets, many people with their eyes welling up, full of tear gas, white clouds down these side streets, and we saw some fires starting. There's still clashes going on in central Cairo. My location, I can still hear the crowds shouting out now and see the lines of police officers on the bridges trying to close off downtown Cairo, trying to isolate these different groups of protesters. We've seen pictures on the Arab satellite channels of protesters on one of the bridges trying to push an armored vehicle into the River Nile.
And what, if we could bring back just to the situation in Giza, there, we received reports here in central Cairo that Mohamed al-Baradei had actually been arrested, but that turned out to be a false report. But we understand the security forces tried to separate him away from the protesters.
Well, what I saw, I wasn't so far away from Mohamed al-Baradei. He's a very distinctive face, of course, was visible among the crowds. When people saw him, they started to close in on him. People, I think, have been quite desperate for some kind of a leading figure for these protests. There were some people very supportive of him, shouting out as soon as they saw him. And I think people were worried about the crush. He was moved, I saw, into the main gates of the mosque, taken away from the violence as it began to unfold with the riot police not far away. So far, of course, Mohamed al-Baradei, who returned to his home country, Egypt, just nearly 1 year ago, he's generally avoided direct confrontation with the regime, with the government here, the regime as he calls it, and he has, you know, kept a lot of his comments to his Twitter account, has tried to activate and encourage supporters here. He's put out a lot of supportive messages this week, but this was his first really big public appearance, and he wasn't able to be seen for long.
Yolande Nell, thank you very much for updating us on what you have seen in Giza earlier today, part of Greater Cairo, what's unfolding on the streets around you in the capital and what we're seeing here as well. I can hear the sirens in the distance again, and we can hear the tear gas canisters being fired from the streets below. Egyptian state television says the security forces have the situation under control. The government has tried to make light of these protests, saying they don't represent the real wishes and aspirations of the Egyptian people. But something is changing on the streets, not just in
Hello,
Cairo,
yeah, I'm still
but
here.
In many places across this country.
Coming up later on NewsHour, on the fourth day of anti-government protests on the streets of Cairo, one young Egyptian tells us why he believes this is the start of a revolution for his country and others in the region.
A regime which is afraid of Facebook and Twitter should only govern Farmville, but not a country like Egypt. We want that regime down. We don't want Mubarak to be there. We want him to go with all the corruption that happened within 30 years of his judgment. And I really ask him to make sure that he has enough fuel in his flight, because I think he will struggle to find a place that can have him.
Much more coming up. You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is NewsHour with James Menendez in London and Lise Doucette in Cairo. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. So what about the response of the United States to what's happening in Egypt? Egypt's one of America's most important allies in the region, partly because of the Middle East peace process and also in the fight against Al-Qaeda. The US gives more than $1 billion worth of military aid each year to Egypt. Well, a couple of days ago, the US Secretary of State Hillary Clinton was still affirming her belief in the stability of the Egyptian government. Yesterday, though, the administration's tone changed, with President Obama calling more forcefully for political and economic reform.
Egypt's been an ally of ours on a lot of critical issues. They made peace with Israel. President Mubarak has been very helpful on a range of tough issues in the Middle East. But I've always said to him that making sure that they are moving forward on reform, political reform, economic reform, is absolutely critical to the long-term well-being of Egypt.
Well, let's talk to Robert Danin, who's a Middle East expert at the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington and also a former State Department official under President Bush. Robert Danin, what does America want to see happen, do you think, in Egypt?
Well, in the short term, the United States would like to see no violence, would like to see the situation calm. They would like to see the administration of Hosni Mubarak stay in power. But they also want to see that administration make quick and dramatic changes to give the protesters reasons to get off the street.
Why do they want the government of President Mubarak to stay in power? Will there not come a point where they say that the aspirations of the protesters and the spread of democracy is more important?
Well, first of all, it's not the United States' call. This is not the we're no longer in colonial era, and the United States is not the kingmaker here.
It does have a lot of influence, though, doesn't it?
It does have a lot of influence, the United States has been engaged in intensive dialogue, both publicly in the comments that you just cited by President Obama and Hillary Clinton, Secretary of State, but also privately. The Secretary of State yesterday had an intensive discussion with the Egyptian foreign minister. And, you know, the United States is calling for peaceful demonstrations. They are articulating the principles of freedom of association, freedom of speech, of reform. At the same time, they're saying that they still back the regime in power. And so they're trying to square a circle. They're trying to articulate and resolve and reconcile two principles here. But the more violent that the situation becomes, the more confrontational it becomes, the more difficult it is to reconcile those two positions.
But if they're talking about freedom of association, what about the freedom for others to lead the country? If there are elections in the future that others can stand and that there are proper elections, unlike the ones last year?
Well, no, I think that's something that the United States would welcome. I think they would very much welcome Mubarak laying out a forward-leaning political pathway out of this crisis that would give reformers and democracy advocates reason to believe that positive change is coming. That's exactly what the United States would like to see. It's something that the United States has been talking to Egypt for some time about. The United States has been telling Egypt, look, your stability, your repression, the status quo is a false status quo. It's on thin ice, and one day that ice is going
to
break.
But isn't now the time to come out with that message loud and clear?
Well, I think it is coming out with that message. It is saying, just as you say, the quote from President Obama yesterday was quite strong in calling on the government not to use violence, saying that we want to see that there's an opportunity to be responsive to the aspirations of the people and pursue economic and social reforms that it can improve their lives. I'm quoting President Obama. That's pretty strong coming from a president to another president who is an ally and a friend.
Many thanks for that. That was Robert Danin of the Council on Foreign Relations. Well, let's talk now to Lilian Daoud of the BBC Arabic's interactive programme, because we want to talk about the role of social media in all this. But, of course, it's been very difficult for people to use their mobile phones and the internet all of today. Lilian Daoud, have any messages at all been getting out of the country?
That's true, James. It is very, very difficult. But despite cutting the internet connection in whole Egypt and ordering the mobile companies to stop their services, we are still managing to get news out from Egypt by the help of the bloggers and the Egyptians and Arabs who are outside Egypt now in other Arab countries.
But Lilian, sorry to interrupt you. How are they doing it then if the internet access has been stopped within Egypt?
Yes, they are calling their parents and friends on landlines, getting the news and publishing it on the internet on their blogs.
What are people then saying from within Egypt, but also from outside? What is the central theme that's emerging?
Well, actually, they want the support of the whole world. They are asking the world to help them. These are mainly the messages that they are trying to spread right the moment. And they are asking the media organization to try their best to cover the events and get the footages.
And are you really getting a sense that people in the region feel that something really is happening at the moment?
Oh, definitely. From the response online, yes, this is definitely what's going on.
Liliane, many thanks. Let's also talk to our Arab affairs analyst, Magdi Abdelhadi, who's on the line from Tunisia, where, of course, this wave of protests began. Magdi, what happened in Tunisia was a seismic shift, but what's happening in Egypt seems to be of a completely different order.
Oh, absolutely. Egypt is much bigger. It's a strategic country for the entire region. It has for many decades inspired revolt or political trends, even music and film fashion. So if Egypt was to go the way Tunisia has gone, then I would expect the ripple effect to be far more intense and serious. And judging from events today, this is clearly an escalation and determination on the part of the government of President Hosni Mubarak to quell this nationwide protest, unprecedented in decades, and so far at least the protesters' determination and resolve to carry on seems unbroken. Mr. Mubarak seems to be in for a very bumpy ride, and if this escalation continues and Mr. Mubarak, questions may be asked about whether his ability to survive this unprecedented confrontation with his people, then definitely everybody across the Middle East would be watching, because Egypt is of a different order than Tunisia.
What might be the tipping point in all this? Is it the sheer numbers of people who turn out?
Numbers, and what seems to be obvious to me now, that the people are no longer afraid. And this also happened in Tunisia, and it seems that the Egyptians have learnt the lesson. Once they break this barrier of fear, if you like, and they go out and continue to push back anti-riot police, prepared to be hit or even shot at, then it's very difficult to put them back in the box. And if they keep this kind of pressure, at one moment, Mr. Mubarak and his people will probably begin thinking, should they call in the army? And if they do that, that would be a very, very serious escalation.
Magdi, sorry to interrupt you. We're just getting a report on the Reuters news agency quoting an eyewitness saying that Egyptian protesters are carrying the dead body of a fellow demonstrator through Suez after those clashes we heard about with police. Does that show the newfound courage of the demonstrators?
Absolutely. And the more people get killed, the more people will be enraged, and they will. It just becomes a vicious cycle, if you like, very difficult to break, and the people will be emboldened. Just one important final point.
Very briefly, Magdi, we're running out of time.
Yeah, Western reaction to this is quite crucial, as you pointed out in your earlier interview. How Washington in particular responds to this will actually be will play a crucial role.
Magdi, many thanks for the moment. That was Magdi Abdelhadi on the line for Tunis. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. Much more to come in the next half hour. You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is NewsHour with Lise Doucette in Cairo and James Menendez in London. And we're just going to turn away from Egypt for a moment to talk about Nelson Mandela, who's been in hospital since Wednesday. Well, that prompted a flurry of speculation about the 92-year-old former president's state of health. Well, a few hours ago, Mr. Mandela was discharged from hospital, and the Surgeon General, Vijay Ramlakhan, told reporters who'd gathered there more about Dr. Mandela's condition.
Dr. Mandela suffers from diseases common to people of his age, as well as conditions that have developed over the years for which he receives chronic medication. He recently developed an acute respiratory infection for which he received treatment and has responded very well. He is stable, but will be monitored closely. We may recall that he suffered from tuberculosis whilst on Robben Island and has had previous respiratory tract infections. He is also not as mobile as before, and over the last few years has had to be assisted with movement. Despite all of this, his amazing positive attitude allows him to cope with the difficulties of old age with the greatest of graces.
Well, our correspondent in Johannesburg is Mike Waldridge, and he told me what'll happen next.
Well, he's going to be cared for at home and, as the Surgeon General said, monitored closely. And I think probably the choice of words there is a very careful one, a deliberate one. As we heard, he spoke about Mr. Mandela being stable at the moment, the medical team regarding his recovery as satisfactory. And I think that I would read into that that they are trying to emphasize to the people of this country and of the world, really, his vulnerability and his frailty. Not only because of this acute respiratory infection that we now learn he's just had and received treatment for, but also all the underlying conditions that he has. Not only the conditions that you might expect for somebody of his age, 92, but also what he's been through. For example, the TB that he had when he was on Robben Island. So I think they were very keen to paint that broad picture of undoubtedly continuing vulnerability, but they clearly feel confident enough to be able to send him home now to receive a kind of care that they obviously feel suits him particularly, not least because of this very positive attitude of his. We heard later on from Khalima Motlanthe, the deputy president at that same news conference, that he had been joking with everybody, that he'd said how happy he was to see him. And when Mr. Motlanthe said they had to come to this news conference, he said, well, I won't detain you any longer. He'd been teasing his present wife, Grasser, and his former wife, Winnie, who'd also been seeing him. So the high spirits very much a part of the picture that they wanted to paint.
Mike, very briefly, have there been any questions they were asked about why it's taken so long to give this full picture of what's been happening?
Yes, there were very pointed questions on that. The response was that they had lessons to learn from this, that indeed there was information they could have released earlier, particularly the fact that he'd gone into hospital, and they said if the same thing were to happen again next time, they would learn the lessons from this occasion.
That was Mike Waldridge in Johannesburg, and just watching some of the latest pictures coming in from Egypt, particularly from Suez, showing the pretty fierce clashes between the security forces and protesters there. There was one shot of an armoured vehicle being used by the police that had been set on fire by the protesters. One of the agencies, news agencies, reporting that one protester has been killed in Suez and that his body has been carried around by fellow protesters around the city. And one other piece of information, as yet still unconfirmed, but Egyptian security officials being quoted by the Associated Press. They say the Nobel Peace Laureate Mohamed al-Baradei, now back in Cairo, is currently under house arrest. We'll try and bring you confirmation of that as and when we get it. So where will all this lead? Do these protests in Egypt mark the start of a major upheaval in North Africa and the wider Middle East? I've been speaking to three people who've been watching developments closely. Essam Margani is an Egyptian living here in London. Ziad Mirsi is a doctor and also a blogger in Tunis. And Ali is an Iranian blogger living in Dubai, although he was there for the protests in Iran in 2009 following the disputed presidential election. Essam first then, what's his reaction to the protests today that have been taking place in Egypt?
I'm actually a very proud Egyptian of the Egyptian people and what's going on over there. It's a shame what the government is doing right now to us. No Facebook, no internet at all, and they switched off the mobile phones. Egypt is sort of isolated. A regime which is afraid of Facebook and Twitter should only govern Farmville, but not a country like Egypt. We want that regime down. We don't want to change faces to get Rashid, who we highly respect, but we don't want Mubarak to be there. We want him to go with all the corruption that happened within 30 years of his judgment.
Do you think that is what's going to happen in the next few days?
Yes, and I really ask him to make sure that he has enough fuel in his flight, because I think he will struggle to find a place that can have him. We want him out.
Is it your feeling that what's been happening in Egypt has been inspired directly by what happened in Tunisia?
Exactly. Thanks to the Tunisian. I'm sorry to say that we were afraid, although we had lots of actions that happened, but Tunisia inspired us and showed us that it's not that far. And I think we are close. We are close to freedom and to be able to really elect a president that we choose ourselves, not that they think that they are able to choose.
Ziad in Tunis, did you ever expect Tunisia to be the starting point for this wave of protests?
When we did it in Tunisia, we were thinking only about Tunisia. But once we succeeded, we completely saw it happening all over the Arab world.
So you thought that there would be a chain reaction?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, the same ingredients are all over the Arab world. Unemployment and then some lack of freedom all over the Arab world. And also the Twitter-Facebook revolution is also taking place all over the Arab world. So those ingredients are there. And then facing them, we can find just dictators who have been more than 20 years in power. So,
but Ziad, so far the revolution in Tunisia isn't over yet. How much has actually changed so far? Are things really becoming free and fair?
Yeah, everything changed already, and that's what's amazing about it. And that's why I hope that everyone in the Arab world would do the same, because now the internet is free. Freedom of demonstration is available anywhere, everywhere, and also freedom of association. And now with the state is becoming more and more accountable. We're seeing ministers every day on TV. We're having debates. Political parties are getting organized. I think the revolution in Tunisia achieved 95% of what the Tunisian people are asking for.
Well, let me just turn to Ali, the Iranian blogger living in Dubai. Iran, of course, not an Arab country, but there are parallels, aren't there? Particularly, as Ziad mentioned, the use of social media in the way demonstrations are organized.
Hi. Yeah, definitely. And not only how the demonstrations are organized, but also how the government is trying to basically fight with it, blocking websites, blocking Facebook, social sites. So there are definitely parallels. And not to forget, we had also a revolution 32 years ago. And I have a very, very mixed feeling when I see what's happening in Egypt and Tunisia.
Why is that?
Okay.
Because of the uncertainty about what might happen next.
Yes, because in one hand, I'm very happy because living in a dictatorship country like in Iran, I absolutely understand what people think in Tunisia, and I absolutely understand what people think in Egypt, and I can feel also the proud people right now have when they see a crowd or going outside trying to fight the dictatorship, because I had the same feeling 1.5 years ago as I was in demonstration in Tehran. But at the same time, and not to forget, in the Middle East we have too many dictators. No matter if the governments are Islamic republics, such as in Iran, or secular republics, just we have too many dictators, and it doesn't hurt us to have less dictators in this part of the world. But this is what we thought before the revolution in Iran. So, but what I'm afraid of, and is really, really scary, is if we see, let's say, an Islamic Republic regime coming in Tunisia and Egypt. Well,
Let me just quickly, we haven't got much time, let me just quickly put that to Essam. Are you worried that there is a lack of coherent opposition in Egypt and there may be a political vacuum?
Well, not really. That's what the regime is trying to do and to spread around. Also, they are trying to scare the world with the Muslim Brothers, which is not true. These demonstrations just were sparked by youth on Facebook and on social media. So that's not true. We have also respected simples who can manage Egypt very well, but they are just being put away by the regime.
That was Essam, and we also heard from Ziad and from Ali. Well, let's talk a little bit more about this issue of leadership and what happens after people are swept from power. One figure who has returned to Cairo in the last 24 hours and has been taking part in today's protest, there are some reports that he's now been placed under house arrest, is the Nobel Peace Laureate Mohamed al-Baradei. Earlier, he did take part in Friday prayers in Giza, and that was just before the demonstrations got underway.
The Egyptian people will take care of themselves. The Egyptian people will be the ones who will make the change. We are not waiting for help or assistance from the outside world. But what I expect from the outside world is to practice what to preach, is to defend the right of the Egyptian for their universal values, freedom, dignity, social justice.
Well, that was Mohammed al-Baradei, and we're just trying to confirm whether he is now confined to his home in Cairo. Dr. Boutros Boutros-Ghali is a former UN Secretary-General, and before that he served for 14 years as President Hosni Mubarak's foreign minister. Does he see parallels with what happened in Tunisia?
What they are asking in Tunisia was to change the government to get rid of Mr. Ben Ali and his family. Here there are students who don't find a job and who are asking for the find the capacity of job. There are very poor people who are not able to eat enough, who are asking. So the problem is more a problem of economic and social problem than a political intervention. I don't believe at all that you will have any change of the system. I believe that, first of all, let us wait what will happen today. We may have a manifestation tomorrow and after tomorrow, but then finished.
Well, that was Boutros Boutros-Ghali. Still with me in the studio is Maha Azam of the Royal Institute of International Affairs here in London, and also Magdi Abdul-Hadi, our Arab affairs analyst, who's in Tunis. Maha, I just want to pick up what Boutros Boutros-Ghali was saying there. That doesn't really seem to chime with, I'm just reading one of the chants that the protesters have been using in Cairo today. Raise your voice, tell the people we've had enough oppression. They do seem to be calling for total change.
Yes, I think anyone watching today and the first day of the demonstrations could hear the slogans of Down with Mubarak, of the Egyptian bloggers and ordinary people on the street saying we want an end to this regime. It doesn't tally with the demands at all. Of course, economics matter. People are living in poverty in that country. Many live on less than $2 a day. The economic situation is extremely bad, very high unemployment. But at the very heart of these protests is the political issue. The call of many for greater accountability, for freedom to demonstrate, for freedom to have meetings, for free and fair elections down the line.
We heard from Mohammed al-Baradei. Is he the man to replace President Mubarak? Does he have enough clout?
I think he's an important focal figure. We don't know. I think he has some supporters. I don't think there's a groundswell of support for him yet. I think it's important that he came back. I think he's respected. He's thought of as not corrupt. All these are good things. But I think what is going to happen much further down the line is free and fair elections, where Mr. al-Baradei, like others, will have the opportunity to run as president, and where political parties can run their candidates, and then the Egyptian people will choose. And I think this is what the young on the streets want, what people from different social backgrounds want in Egypt today. I don't think that we're talking about one political grouping or one political orientation today.
Let me just turn to Magdi Abdul-Hadi in Tunis. And Magdi, the experience of Tunisia is interesting because when President Ben Ali fled the country, there was a time when it wasn't clear who was going to replace him. Who was in charge? Has that now been resolved?
Far from it, really, because we still have an interim government. We're due to have an election in about 60 days, presidential elections. And part of the problem, of course, with authoritarian rulers like Ben Ali or Mubarak is that when they leave behind them a trail of political destruction, a barren political landscape, because it's part of the game. That's how they control society. They do not allow a mature political culture to emerge, people who can compete openly and fairly for political power. And Egypt inevitably, if Mubarak ever leaves suddenly or forced to step down, may find itself in a very similar situation, with the only coherent force in the country, or institution, I should probably say, is the army. Parties in Egypt are weak. Apart from the Muslim Brotherhood, all the other parties are really no grassroots support. So this is a tradition of authoritarian rule across the region, so Egypt is not, or Tunisia is, unique in that respect. I just have to say something about Mr. al-Baradei. I think the reason the regime was so terrified, if you like, of al-Baradei, because for many years Mr. Mubarak presented himself as the only game in town, either him or fundamentalists. Now there is some possible middle ground person is emerging, and they really try to get rid of that.
Okay, Magdi, many thanks. Magdi Abdul-Hadi in Tunis. Maha Azam, many thanks for joining us. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. You're listening to the BBC. This is James Menendez in London and Lise Doucette in Cairo with NewsHour. A reminder of our main news. Police cracked down on protesters in the streets of Cairo. A BBC reporter was one of those attacked.
When they came, they arrested me. I said, I'm BBC. They didn't care about BBC or any other organisation. They were targeting journalists deliberately. They took my camera away, and when they arrested me, they started beating me up with steel bars, like the ones used here for animals, for slaughtering animals. And it's been really, really brutal.
The experience of one BBC reporter of those demonstrations in Egypt. One other headline, Nelson Mandela has been released from hospital in Johannesburg after being treated for a respiratory illness. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC. Well, as you could guess by our coverage so far of Friday prayers in Cairo this morning, it wasn't so much a time for spiritual reflection as a period of heightened tension. But it was a pause largely respected by both anti-government demonstrators and the police. Afterwards, though, as we've been hearing, the clashes intensified with thousands upon thousands of people on the streets. The BBC's John Sudworth has spent all morning in Cairo. This is his report.
Well, this is the El Fat Mosque, one of Cairo's biggest, and looking up, I can see its proud boast, the city's tallest minaret. These are the midday prayers and a moment of strange, tense calm. Before the authorities shut down the internet and all mobile phone services in this city, those networks had been buzzing with activist chatter, the same electric energy that has propelled and sustained the protests here this week. One text message implored people to head to the closest main square after these prayers are finished. I'm here with Rania Sabri from the BBC's Africa service, and she's been telling me that there's something very interesting being said here in this sermon that people are listening to.
Anybody who tries to ignite chaos or vandalise property, he's harming all Muslims, and Allah would not accept that. That's basically what he's saying.
Now, that's interesting. There's a reason, perhaps, why that message is being given out today.
Actually, all mosques in Egypt are registered under the Minister of Alms, the Minister of Alms actually appoints their preachers, and they direct their sermons, what should be said and what should not be said.
Outside the mosque, ranks of riot police are forming up, and milling around with them, there are dozens upon dozens of rather sinister and threatening plain-clothed security men. And then suddenly, from the doors of the mosque, the tension and anger that have been lurking always in the background today suddenly burst forward. So that's prayers just finished there now, and you can hear straight away the crowds on the steps of the mosques have begun shouting and raising their hands. It's a remarkable outburst of anger and energy at the end of Friday prayers. Let's go to Tahrir Square, we heard them whisper just before this outburst.
Mubarak, Mubarak, good boy, Dawood Mubarak. We need a Mubarak, anything's new.
What's happening there?
Now the beating has started and the tear gas, you can hear the bomb going up. And the people were chanting Silmeya, Silmeya, which means it's a peaceful demonstration. It's a peaceful demonstration. And that's a sign that at some point the beating and the tear gas has started.
Yeah, well, we can hear the sounds of the tear gas being fired now at the end of the street, probably 100 metres or so from where I'm standing. But the crowd, as you can hear, still incredibly angry, continuing to chant. And we can start to smell the... In fact, they fired the tear gas into the crowds now. We can start to smell it. And you can see people leaping over the barriers, away from the tear gas clouds now. In fact, both sides now, the tear gas is coming in. That's an intense smell there. We're heading into the tear gas, and that's a choking sensation. Crowds now heading in every direction, some of them leaping over the fence back into the mosque. Succeeded very definitely in dispelling with great haste the crowd that had assembled in front of the mosque.
That was our correspondent John Sudworth in Cairo. Well, one of the other focuses for the violence today has been Suez. This is what our correspondent there, Rupert Wingfield Hayes, told me a little earlier.
Well, I can tell you that in the last half hour or so, there has begun a full-scale confrontation here in the centre of Suez between riot police and about, I would estimate, around 3,000 or so protesters who gathered after Friday prayers in the middle of the city. Today here in Suez, there is no internet, there is no mobile phone network. We heard the imam in the mosque across the street from us here calling on people not to go out onto the streets, not to take part in protests. That simply hasn't happened. Immediately Friday prayers was over, people started coming out onto the streets, started gathering in large crowds, calling for the downfall of the Mubarak government, and then they started marching up the street towards the police station. It was initially a peaceful protest. It's not exactly clear what happened. It looks like the police responded with tear gas, and now we have a full-scale confrontation. There's tear gas grenades. An armoured riot vehicle has been taken over and set ablaze, and you can probably hear there's gunfire and tear gas grenades being fired in the background as I speak.
What sort of numbers of police and security forces are there, and is it your sense that they're perhaps not able to control the situation at the moment?
Well, it's as it has been the last few days. I mean, they had called for much larger protests here for workers from factories and the oil refineries, very large oil industry here in Suez, to come out onto the streets. It's not clear whether that has happened. This is only one site. I've been told that there are two other large-scale protests also taking place outside other mosques in the centre of, in other parts of Suez as well. So this, clearly, the situation is not under control. The police are trying to break up the protests, but people are basically running into the back streets, regrouping and then coming back out, throwing stones, setting fire. They set fire to one police vehicle. They're trying to set fire to a police station as well. So it's a very chaotic situation. The police certainly do not have it under control.
Rupert Wingfield Hayes there in Suez. Still with me, Magdi Abdulhadi and Dr. Maha Azhar. Magdi, I understand you've been hearing a bit more about what's been happening in Suez.
Well, it largely in line with what Rupert has been saying, that it is getting nastier and nastier and more violent. Protesters setting one police station on fire and managing to get hold of the weapons there. While at the same time this is happening, let me just tell you to what extent the Egyptian regime itself seems to be at least partly in denial. The state television has been telling Egyptians that there have been some demonstrators after the Friday prayers, but they were all peaceful. That gives you an idea of to what extent the Egyptian regime is really rattled by this, and they're trying as hard as they could to contain the spread of the violence and to reassure the wider population that everything is fine. But I don't think many people will believe that.
Maha Azam, on that issue of trying to contain the protests, where do the loyalties of the army and police stand in Egypt?
I think for now, with the regime, but I think there are questions being asked by both institutions. And for all we know within the army now, there are many that feel that they can't back Mubarak anymore. I think the key is how long these protests last, and I don't think they're going to give up. I think they're going to gain momentum. They're going to increase in strength. And as we see that, cracks will appear in the security forces and in the army. It's a matter of time. What we're seeing now is the beginning of something as momentous as the fall of the communist regimes in Eastern Europe. It's no less momentous. It's early days yet, but just as important to the region as a whole.
Magdi, briefly, is that how you see it? And can this really be an orderly process of reform?
Orderly is hardly the word. As we mentioned earlier, there are no really political structures in place to ensure a peaceful transition of power. But I do fully agree with Dr. Azam's assessment that this is momentous. And I won't make any predictions because this is a fast-moving story. But clearly, the people are in no mood to go back home anytime soon.
Magdi Abdulhadi in Tunis, many thanks. And also my thanks to Dr. Maha Azam of the Royal Institute of International Affairs. For more on this developing story in Egypt, don't forget our website, bbc.com/news. There you'll find a link to our live page with all the latest information from our correspondents and also eyewitnesses. But for now, that's it for this edition of News Hour. From me in London and Lise Doucette in Cairo and the rest of the team, thank you for listening and goodbye.